All rise, please. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Thank you very much. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Idaho Supreme Court. April 9, 2025, for our first hearing of the day. The court is being held today at University of Idaho College of Law. We note that and appreciate the welcome we've had here so far, and appreciate the dean and the rest of those involved in making our stay very, very good. So we thank you for that. The first case we will hear this morning is entitled State of Idaho versus Dwayne Edward Best. In this matter, Mr. Best appeals. He's represented here by Justin Curtis. The state is responding, represented by Ken Jorgensen. Counsel, do either of you have anything preliminary to argument this morning?
No, Your Honor.
Very well, sir. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Dwayne Best appeals from his judgment of conviction for possession of a controlled substance with the intent to deliver, trafficking in heroin, and unlawful possession of a firearm. He received three sentences of life with 10 years fixed, and on appeal, he's raised two issues for this court's consideration. The first is whether the district court erred by denying his motion to suppress, and the second was whether the district court erred by limiting his closing argument. I'm going to submit the second issue on the briefs today. With one exception, I am going to inform the court that based on the state's relevance argument and its response brief, I'm going to withdraw the claim regarding the prosecutor's charging decisions, as far as that was mentioned in the closing arguments, which just leaves a harmless error analysis on issue two.
And just to clarify, issue two being the body cam.
Correct.
Okay.
So Mr. Best raised three claims on appeal with regard to his motion to suppress. The first, that the state failed to show that he was subject to a Fourth Amendment waiver as a term of his probation. The second, that the officers that searched his room did not do it at his request, or did not request his consent to the search. And three, that the state did not meet its burden to show that the officers had reasonable grounds to conduct the search in this case. And I will address each of these in turn. So with regard to the waiver issue, Mr. Best submits that the evidence the state submitted at the hearing does not show a valid Fourth Amendment waiver. So in this case, Mr. Best filed a motion to suppress, and in his motion to suppress, he asserted that the evidence found in the room that he was staying should have been suppressed because the room was searched without a warrant.
Counsel, given that we're here at the law school, could you provide a little factual background before you go into the legal analysis you're about to embark on?
Sure. So this case started off on, I think it's April 13th, 2021, when several probation officers and police officers went to search a house. I believe it was in Coeur d'Alene or somewhere out, just in the outskirts. And a number of officers and probation officers showed up to that house. That house was inhabited by a number of people. I think the record shows that several of them were on probation. Mr. Best was on probation, and he was staying in a back room of that house. So the officers arrived. They met with a woman who was on probation named Julia Conacond, and she let them into the house. They went around the house, and eventually...
Was he living in a back room of the house, or was he living in a separate vehicle that was behind the house?
It's kind of described strangely in the about what they're saying. I get a sense that it was like an addition or something to the back of the house.
Was it connected to the house?
That's my understanding of the record. I don't know. I don't think it matters for purposes of what we're arguing today. But he was staying in kind of an attached room in the back of the house.
As you know, there's an amicus in this case. Their brief makes it sound like he was living in a van down by the river on the same lot. I'm just curious about the different view of the facts here.
My understanding from what the probation officers testified to was that it was a room at the back of the house. Now, if I'm misunderstanding that, I apologize, but honestly, then this court can review the transcript for any more clear analysis as to where he was staying. But I interpreted it as kind of like an addition to the back of the house But my understanding was it was attached, but if the court, if it bears out differently in the transcripts, then this court should obviously defer to what was in there. So eventually they do go to the room that Mr. Best is staying. There's a dispute in the records as far as whether they knocked or not. One officer couldn't remember. One officer said they did knock. Eventually Mr. Best, they said, was drowsy and kind of out of it, but did say, you know, open the door. They went into the room and then discovered methamphetamine, heroin, a gun in a safe. And they questioned Mr. Best and eventually arrested him on those three charges. So, as I say, he filed the motion to suppress. He asserted that the evidence taken from the room that he was staying in was seized without, was taken without a warrant, and asked that it be suppressed. This case is kind of unique, I guess, in that there wasn't much to happen. the motion to suppress is just about a page long. There was no briefing done by either side in the motion to suppress, so it just goes to the court on an evidentiary hearing. And at the evidentiary hearing, two of the probation officers testified, Clifford and Keating, about what happened that day. Trial counsel for Mr. Best, when questioning one of the probation officers, pointed to a judgment of conviction from the year 2001 that contained a clause saying that Mr. Best had waived his right or had agreed to consent to searches at the request of his probation officer. The state, in reply to that, then brought up, no, there's actually a much more recent term of probation here, and it's from a case from 2018. And that's the document that the state asserted showed that Mr. Best had waived his Fourth Amendment rights. And the state also asserted at that time, like, you know, it would be highly unlikely that someone from a 2001 agreement would still be on probation. And the state asserted then that the 2018 agreement applied.
And that agreement is not part of the record, is it?
The 2018 agreement is. The court took judicial notice of that, and I think that we filed a motion to augment with it. So my understanding is that it is in the record.
Sorry, I haven't been able. I looked for the motion to augment that, and I couldn't find it. I have one motion to augment from Mr. Best, and it sought copies to augment the copies of all exhibits admitted at his jury trial. And so the court granted that motion to augment, but I haven't been able to find a motion to augment with the 2018 agreement. So I don't want you to burn a bunch of time right now on it, but maybe...
Yes, I will certainly take a look at that. I have a copy at my desk. We have it in our file. It is what is represented down below. It's a judgment of conviction, order of attainder, or not an order of attainder. It's an order of putting him on probation.
Right. I mean, the difficulty, you know, is if it's not in the record, we presume it supports the district court's decision. And so where I understand your argument to be based on the agreement isn't signed, if we don't have the agreement in the record, I don't know how we can, I mean, there's a preservation issue aside from whether it's in the record or not. Even if we get past the preservation issue, if it's not in the record, our precedent would say we have to presume the missing document supports the district court's determination that the 2018 agreement provided evidence of consent to the search.
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, we are the appellant. It is our burden to provide a record and to show error in the district court. As I say, I thought that we had done that and it was in our record. If it's not, I mean, that never came up with the Court of Appeal. I don't think the state's ever asserted it's not in the record. So I will double check that and file the appropriate motion to get it in front of the court. And if we did miss that, I apologize.
If I could ask you a question about that. The Fourth Amendment waiver that was part of the 2018 judgment, did that waiver come from the text of the judgment itself? Or from an attached agreement of supervision?
So let me see if I can try to find it really quick.
Okay.
Okay, so the document is this. It's entitled the Retained Jurisdiction Disposition and Notice of a Right to Appeal. It has the district court's order imposing the sentence and placing him on probation. Then there is an attached terms of conditions of probation that goes forward that has some of the judge's notes on it. And as I say, it's signed by the district courts, but then not by Mr. Best.
And the Fourth Amendment
is in that attached It is, yes.
What's the date of that, if you just mind?
Filed in Kootenai County, July 11th, 2018. And so, as I say, initially, counsel for Mr. Best was pointing to an agreement from 2001 that had a different term of waiver than this one does. And so once Mr. Best's attorney pointed that out, the state countered that and said, no, that's not the agreement, that's not the document that we're using to show consent in this case. We're using the document from 2018 to show consent in this case. As I say, asked the court to take judicial notice of it. The district court did take judicial notice of it. This court did eventually rule that I am finding that this document is the document that placed Mr. Best on probation and that term applied in this case. Our position today is the district court ruled on that issue, and therefore it's preserved for appeal because the judge was confronted with a dispute as to which agreement would apply. The state asserted that the 2018 agreement applied. The district court agreed that the 2018 agreement applied. The only way that the district court could then determine that Mr. Best was subject to the Fourth Amendment waiver in this case was determining that this document showed a full voluntary consent in this case. And I would submit that this document by itself doesn't do that. As I say, it's not signed by Mr. Best. In response to some of the arguments that went on down below, Mr. Best did point out that the terms and conditions of probation must be knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
And counsel discussion, I read those knowing and voluntary comments from Mr. Best counsel below. He's talking about it in terms of who did he consent to allow to search him. And so his arguments were focused on he consented to allow his probation officer or an agent of his probation officer to search, and that because the individuals who searched were not authorized by his specific probation officer, his waiver wasn't knowing and voluntary because he didn't agree to allow anybody else. My struggle with the preservation argument is when I look at the arguments raised below and the state shows up and says, no, it's the 2018 agreement, Mr. Best's counsel is given an opportunity to look at the agreement. At no point does he say, this isn't valid because it's not signed. This isn't appropriate evidence because it's not signed. And so where he never made that specific objection below, I'm struggling with how he can now come up on appeal and say, oh, it's not valid because it wasn't signed.
So my initial response to that is that nothing that Mr. Vest did at that hearing reduced what the state's burden of proof was. It was always on the state to show a valid consent exception to the warrant requirement. And so our argument is essentially that you can challenge that. You can argue that the district court's either factual findings are wrong, or the legal conclusions are wrong, or that a finding is clearly erroneous. And that's really what we're saying here, is that the evidence presented by the state didn't meet that.
Right. And Mr. Best also has a corresponding obligation when a state puts in its evidence to say it doesn't meet the state's burden because. And let me try and equate it, because as I was thinking about this, I thought this argument taken to its logical conclusion would mean you could sit through an entire jury trial, the state could put in its evidence, the court could instruct the jury could make a finding, and then on appeal, the defendant could come in and attack all of the evidence on the basis that it was always the state's burden. I mean, explain to me how those two situations aren't equivalent, because when I hear the argument on this, I'm thinking about how far is this going to be carried?
Well, I think the defense can raise for the first time on appeal sufficiency of the evidence to support a conviction at trial, regardless of what the questions raised or...
And that's fair. Let me drill down a little bit more. So say the state puts in some forensic evidence and the defendant has arguments about chain of custody, doesn't he have to raise those chain of custody arguments below? He can't wait until appeal to raise them, can he?
I agree. And that's because the district court never had the opportunity to rule on the chain of custody issue.
And that's, isn't that the same here, where the district court didn't have the opportunity to address the argument that this is invalid because it's not signed?
I don't think so, because the district court still had the opportunity to determine whether or not the state had validly proven the consent exception, and that's what the district court did here. The district court found that this document satisfied the state's burden.
Does it make any difference that this district court was the same district court that imposed those terms and conditions? I mean, he's being handed an agreement and essentially said, these are the terms and conditions you imposed on him, and can't he say, yeah, I did.
Can't the district court say that?
Right, and recall, because he's taken judicial notice and there's no objection to judicial notice, he can recall the hearing and everything else. I
still think that would be the state's burden, and I think, you know, like, the, you know, when there's a case from this court recently called State versus Poole that kind of deals with what the requirements should be to show a valid waiver. And this court went through, you know, and like, there was some strange proceedings in Poole because it was the pandemic and all of that. But this court, you know, stated that it, you know, it regretted that it didn't have the opportunity to address this issue because there was no cross appeal by Ms. Poole in that case. And this court had said that, you know, three things that they, you know, that you thought should have been satisfied were, in addition to just an agreement, that the agreement be signed, that it be attached to a judgment of conviction, and that the plea colloquy would demonstrate that it was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
Well, to find that it was an agreement, we're not talking about drilling into facts like chain of custody and those kind of things. To even make the basic conclusion or finding of the district court that this was an agreement, don't agreements have to be signed by two parties?
Yes.
It would seem to me that this would be so facially invalid, since it was missing a signature, that the court couldn't even begin to make such a finding until it ascertained where's the version that has the signature on.
Yes, I mean, I agree. Like, you know, the district court was presented with this document. I think the district court, as I say, like, implicitly found that, like, this document by itself showed that knowing and intelligent waiver, and just on its own, the document can't show that.
I mean, I get that a court doesn't always have time to read through a probation agreement. They can look to see if it was signed.
Yes, and
there's no question there.
Okay. Yeah, and I just wanted to point out, as far as, you know, Justice Ahn, about like how he was talking, or, you know, your interpretation of what he was saying was that, you know, that his consent didn't go to anyone beyond his probation officer. You know, I think that argument is still in reliance on the 2001 agreement, and our position here today is the 2001 agreement has nothing to do with this case.
And I agree with you. I mean, where I see him extending it to 2018 is initially he's focused on, he didn't authorize anyone other than his probation officer, and then the state introduces the 2018 agreement, and they read it, and it appears Mr. Best's counsel latches on to or agent of, and so in his summation, his wind-up of his motion to suppress, he expands it and says, he didn't give consent to the probation officer, anyone other than the probation officer, or an agent of the probation officer. So I have trouble seeing how he was actually arguing something broader in terms of knowing involuntary.
Well, our position is that once he raised that at all with regard to that term of the agreement, I mean, that's a challenge to that term. I mean, it doesn't make sense to say Mr. Best only agreed to half of the term that is listed here in the 2018 agreement.
Well, it sounds like, again, this discussion we're having is focusing on two different things, about the facial validity of the agreement versus the scope of the agreement. And the arguments that were raised below were focused totally on the scope of the agreement, correct?
As I say, based on defense counsel's incorrect assumption that the 2001 agreement had something to do with this case, I still think defense counsel, by arguing that there wasn't a knowing and voluntary waiver of the, you know, of all people, encompasses a challenge that Mr. Best did not knowingly agree to this term in the 2018 agreement. And I think that the state kind of acknowledges that, because the state then, in arguing about why the motion should be denied, specifically says, the idea that we need to get into a knowing and voluntary analysis into his waiver, I think, is incorrect. That was done on the record when the court imposed probation, or granted probation, rather. So I think the state is recognizing that there is a challenge being raised to whether Mr. Best knowingly and voluntarily agreed to the 2018 agreement, and the state is asserting that he had because it would have been done on the record. And the problem is that the state did not present anything about what was done on the record.
Why do we assume that the waiver was done on the record? Isn't it pretty common for those agreements to be signed? This one, of course, wasn't signed, which is the problem. But aren't these agreements usually signed after sentencing? The defendant goes to the probation office, probation officer goes over, and this is what the judge ordered, sign it. I mean, typically these are signed after.
I mean, that certainly does happen. We've seen transcripts where the court just does read the terms, and or if there's one that is particularly of note or of interest to the court will say, you know, I want to direct your attention to, you know, number 29 here, and that's going to be a concern to me. So it is often done on the record, but not, as you say, not all the time.
It typically will be summarized in some way by the court of sentencing, correct? And then, but the actual signature on that takes place frequently in the probation office.
I apologize if it's not in the record again, but I mean, this document does have a place for Mr. Best's signature, and it is not there. And
so going back to the motion to suppress argument you mentioned by the state, did Ms. Price raise that in her argument, correct? I think that's what you were
saying. Yes, it's toward the end of the suppression hearing, page 58. That's the state's argument.
Was there any evidence introduced by the state at the motion to suppress argument of that plea colloquy, of going over the terms and conditions?
No, Your Honor. That's ultimately the problem with this case. That I agree that if the state had submitted, you know, a transcript or something that showed, or even just a signature, that would likely suffice, and I don't think we'd be here today on this argument. That is our position on that one. I'm getting into my rebuttal time a little bit, but I did want to address the second claim that we've raised about the reasonable grounds argument that that regardless of the terms of probation that the officers could search Mr. Best's room because of the reasonable grounds argument. So just by virtue of being on probation, regardless of the terms, probationers obviously have a reduced expectation of privacy. They're not like an average citizen that is entitled to, you know, a warrant for searching everything. And under this court's decision in Cleanway, they decided that officers may conduct a search if the officer has reasonable grounds to believe that the probationer has violated a condition of his probation and the search is reasonably related to the disclosure or confirmation of that violation. And it's our position here that the state did not present any evidence that would meet this standard. The only evidence at the suppression hearing is a question and answer. Were you aware of the use of a confidential informant in determining whether or not to conduct a search at this residence? Answer, that is the information that I received was a confidential informant provided information. So we have nothing in the record here that shows what that information was, how that information would have indicated a violation of the probation, what it would have been a violation of probation of, what they would have expected to find, and there is no evidence in our record here that the search was reasonably related to the disclosure of evidence related to that violation, because as I say, there is no evidence as to what that violation would be or what the evidence is at all. And so,
and on top of that, we don't know how the PO knows that the information came from a confidential form.
Correct. Yeah. It is literally just one question and answer is the only information regarding that in this case.
And his answer suggests he didn't directly receive the information from a confidential informant. We told him.
Right. Yeah. You know, and the state relies on the Griffin case about, you know, like an unauthenticated tip from an officer can provide suspicion, but I would note in that case, like it came from an officer. An officer has decided that this information is reliable enough to send it on to somebody else. And there was an actual allegation of what the actual violation was. It was either guns or drugs in Griffin, but so they had that. And we just had neither of those in this case. And because of that, Mr. Best would respectfully request that this court reverse the order denying his motion to suppress, vacate his judgment of conviction, and remand this case.
Let me ask you a question before I sit down. Is it a reasonable inference that the information came from a police officer since there's an information to the probation officer? The probation officer didn't receive it directly from a confidential informant, and police officers and POs went into the room. So is there a reasonable inference that the information that a confidential informant gave came to the PO via law enforcement?
I just don't think there's enough in there to support that inference, Your Honor. Just based on just the one quick answer we have, you know, that officer didn't disclose any means of just how the confidential informant's tip came down the line. And so I would submit that we can't make that.
Don't. You say the officer didn't disclose. Was the officer ever asked?
Asked to disclose?
Yeah.
Oh, was there, like, further questioning by anybody about that? No. This was literally it.
One question, one answer.
Yes.
Well,
I mean, there is a statement that someone makes about that they know that he uses heroin, but there was an objection made to that. The district court sustained that objection, and therefore it's our position that that information is not before the court. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'd like to address just a little bit the preservation issue initially. Just by way of background, as I'm sure this court is aware, it does not address issues that are not preserved below. That generally means that either the district court actually addressed that issue or was specifically asked to address that issue. If neither of those things is present, then the issue is not preserved. This court shouldn't address it. There's several bases behind that general rule, and I would submit that the primary one is so that this court can make correct decisions. In other words, this court is much more likely to make the correct decision in a case if an issue has been fully vetted. If an issue has not been vetted in the district court, then this court will often lack a sufficient basis to apply the law to the facts and come up with a good decision. And that just simply didn't happen in this case. The issue that was presented by Mr. Best in relation to the suppression motion was that the officers exceeded the scope of the probation search because it was conducted by officers other than the probation officer specifically assigned to Mr. Best. That was his argument. That was the argument that the court addressed. The court then went on its own initiative to address the special needs exception and found that applied as well. However, the arguments presented on appeal do not match the arguments made below and only address the district court's finding in relation to the special needs exception and without addressing the consent ruling actually made by the district court, which is no, it wasn't limited to your assigned probation officer.
So, Mr. Jorgensen, can you address Mr. Curtis's argument? I'm thinking of it as sort of a two-pronged argument. One is the burden is on the state to establish consent as an exception here that applies. And two, the defendant doesn't have an obligation to object if the evidence submitted by the state to meet that burden is plainly insufficient.
I would address that in two ways. First off, the burden of proof is not the burden to establish an issue. It's the burden to present evidence. Now, the evidence has to prove certain things, but those things are often going to be defined by the parties, in other words, by the scope of what's really at issue. So in this particular case, what Mr. Best put at issue was the scope of the consent, not the validity of the consent itself. There was a passing reference at best to the validity of the consent, but the argument was that the scope of that consent was exceeded. In fact, that argument more or less concedes that there was a consent in place. There was a valid consent in place. You can't exceed the scope of a consent that was never given, for example.
And I understand your argument. Let me try and ask my question a different way, which is if he says this is illegal because it's a warrantless search, mm-hmm. and the state comes forward and says we have a valid exception, it's consent, here's the 2018 terms and conditions that you agreed to.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no evidence he agreed to them. It's just a piece of paper without a signature. Has the state met its burden to establish consent?
Well, I assume you're asking a hypothetical because there was evidence, but we can talk about that later. The whole idea that the state has the burden of proof is that the state has to present evidence, yes. But that doesn't mean that the defense can say, okay, you've got the burden of proof, the state presents its proof, and then on appeal for the first time say, wait a minute, the state didn't present evidence of X or Y or Z. And I think that one of the best analogies here would be if it was a preservation by the state. So let's say the state presented evidence, and the evidence supported three different theories by which suppression should be denied. But the state only argued two of those. Is the fact that the state presented evidence of that third theory now preserved for appellate review? Well, of course it isn't. Because it was never argued by the state, it was never presented by the state. So I think that that presents a very clear-cut case where the issues and the evidence don't necessarily match up. So it, to preserve an issue for appeal, it isn't enough that you say, well, the other side has the burden of proof. Well, you know, in civil cases on summary judgment motion, if you make a summary judgment motion and you define certain issues, you then can't complain about the proof that you get in response. Now, I understand this motion was very vague, but it is apparent from the hearing transcript that really was Best's issue in this case, was whether suppression should be granted for the fact that the search was conducted by somebody other than his assigned probation officer. So, you know, the fact that we didn't prove something that didn't come up, that wasn't actually raised as an issue till appeal is a little bit contrary to, I think, that this court's established precedents. So just being able to transfer the burden of proof doesn't relieve a party entirely of defining the issues, and it certainly doesn't relieve them of their duty to preserve through argument and through getting the decision actually made by the trial court. And I think that that is very important in a situation like this, because if the argument were actually made and if it were actually decided by the trial court, there is a lot more evidence than the lack of a signature. The lack of a signature isn't it. We do know that he was on probation. We know that he accepted the benefits of probation. We do know that this was a judicial document. This was a judgment filed in court.
So are you suggesting that a defendant is held to the terms of probation through estoppel?
No, what I am suggesting
is... sounds like that's what you're arguing.
Not at all, Your Honor. What I am suggesting is that when you accept the benefit of the probation, then you have accepted the terms thereof, which were entered in a court document.
Isn't that kind of estoppel?
I don't believe it's estoppel, no. It's more along the lines of evidence that, in fact, he was on probation. In fact, he was subject to the terms thereof.
So isn't it vitiate knowing and intelligent?
I'm not sure how, Your Honor.
If you make the argument that he accepts the benefits of probation, therefore he has accepted the terms of an agreement, but we have in our law a requirement that it be a knowing, intelligent waiver of his rights to object to a search, for example. That's what we're mm-hmm. talking about. Does simply that he's on probation, he accepted benefits of probation, therefore he consents to that, vitiate that knowing and intelligent requirement?
Not at all, Your Honor, because we're drawing an inference here. Now, admittedly, it would have been a lot better for me if the prosecutor would have put on either a signed document or a transcript or court minutes where he accepted these terms where they were read to him. But I think that under the circumstances, as Justice Zahn pointed out, this was the same judge who put him on probation. Under that circumstance, it would have been proper for this court to draw that inference and say, yes, you did in fact accept this probation with knowledge that it included this fourth waiver. And if the court had made that factual finding under this record, that would be preserved and that would be the issue before this court. As it is, this court is effectively making its own factual determination as to the validity of this waiver.
Well,
So is it the state's position then a signature on a probation agreement is unnecessary? Just as long as the parties abide by it for a period of time, the signature is not necessary?
No, it's unnecessary if he accepts the probation with knowledge that that term is there.
But there's no evidence of that.
Well, that's the inference, Your Honor. He was on probation. This was a judgment. The inference is that this judgment, judgments are entitled to a standard of normal, I forget the exact phrase, perhaps one of you can help me out, but there is a presumption that applies to a judgment that it was entered according to proper procedures. Therefore, the very fact that there's a judgment, that he's on probation, creates an inference that he was put on probation according to proper procedures, which would have been included, including pronouncing that judgment in his presence. Now, is there a possibility that those procedures weren't followed? I guess there's always that possibility, but the presumption goes against it. And again, if that had been put before the trial court, and if the court had made that factual finding would be subject to the clear error standard, which is this clear error?
A probation agreement, I think, by its very nature, is somewhat of an adhesion contract. Would you not agree? The defendant doesn't have a lot of choice in the matter.
Well, it's not a good choice. It's not a choice any of us want
to fix.
It's
a choice between prison and probation.
Exactly.
It's still somewhat of an adhesion contract. Do we ever infer that an adhesion contract has been signed when there's no signature?
Been signed when there's no signature. We wouldn't do that, but I don't think that looking at this as an adhesion contract is exactly correct, because it isn't really a contract. It's an order of the court. Now, he can refuse the order of the court, but
it's called a probation agreement.
Yes. And contract is analogous, but I would say it's not necessarily exactly on point.
Well, I think you're suggesting that the district court likely obtained his agreement, or else
yes.
The district court would not have put him on probation.
Exactly. In other words, we all know what the normal course is. There at a sentencing hearing, and the district court says, I'm going to put you on probation, and here are the terms and conditions thereof, and then it gets entered as a judgment. Now, this one got entered as a judgment without the actual order. There's probably a signed document somewhere, but we all know what the normal procedure is. So, because of that presumption of regularity, I finally found the term, the presumption of regularity, we would assume that all of that happened on the presumption of regularity. So how much burden does the state have beyond that? Again, it wouldn't have been clear error if this had been raised and if the court made that factual finding and said, yes, I put you on probation, and yes, I read these terms to you in open court, and yes, you are, in fact, on probation that includes a valid fourth waiver. That would not be a serious issue for this court to consider. And so we actually have a situation where the appellant is trying to take advantage of the fact that he did not raise this issue in order to claim error. So even if it were preserved, we would have to assume that the court found it valid. That evidence is sufficient. It's not the best. It's not the most overwhelming, but it is sufficient, even if preserved. And I think most importantly, it's not preserved because we don't have that factual finding, because the Mr. Best never asked the court to make it.
The trial court here took judicial notice of the 2018 document. When a court takes judicial notice of a document, what is it doing in essence? What does it practically mean for the state?
I'm not sure what it practically means to the state is going to be much help, but we have a rule, and we know what the rule says, and we know how the rule works, and it probably should have been handled better below in terms of that document. I'm not even sure it's actually in the record. I've seen it, but I can't speak to. I was just looking here as the argument was going on, trying to find it, but. I know I've seen it. I don't know if it's in the record. I can't respond to that. But in terms of your question, what judicial notice means is that when we have a judicial document, in this case a judgment of conviction, an order of probation, What the court is doing is it is taking judicial notice that the document exists and that it's valid.
And that's all it's doing, right? Yep, I see the piece of paper. It's from another case. It's not this case.
Right.
I see it. It looks official. All right, I'm now looking at it. Does the state in this case do anything else to establish Best's waiver or consent? Oh, consent, that's the proper term. Consent beyond asking the court to take judicial notice of a document.
Well, there was also testimony from the probation officers generally about him being on probation and subject to search conditions. Nothing specific, though. So, yes, it is primarily the fact that we have a judgment of conviction, an order of probation, that included a condition that he be subject to searches. So, again, his argument was the scope of that was exceeded, not that the waiver itself, not that the consent itself was somehow invalid or never given. I mean, that's really what his argument here is. I mean, he's couched it as voluntariness. But in fact, you would have to conclude, in order to accept his argument, that he was completely unaware of it. As Justice Mueller has pointed out, probation is very similar to a contract of adhesion. And it's because of the frankly bad choice that we give them. It's very rare that a defendant is going to sit there and say, yeah, you know what, I would rather serve my life sentence. Or actually, we don't know, I don't remember what the sentence was that he took in favor of probation, but I'd rather sit in prison than get the opportunity of probation. But that doesn't render it involuntary. Really, the only thing that would render it involuntary would be if he wasn't given the chance to reject it.
Right, but I guess my problem is we know he's on the evidence, as we've discussed, is there's judicial notice of the existence of a judgment with a probation agreement attached, and we know that he's on probation. Other than that, any other evidence of what this man agreed to do with respect to consent? Did the state present any other testimony?
Not in relation to the scope of the consent, no.
I struggle with applying the presumption of regularity here, where different judges use different colloquies in different circumstances. So there's if there was a directive from the court and you must read this and it was given, every judge did it that way, maybe you get closer to a presumption of regularity there, but where different judges are free to use their own colloquies in different situations, I struggle with saying the presumption of regularity means we should assume the judge read every single term and condition on that document to him.
Right, but by the same token, why would we presume he was completely unaware? This is somebody who obviously has been on probation before, who obviously knows that these things are part of any regular probation.
Yes, but look at the record in this case. We've got two very different terms of two different consents depending upon what probation agreement you're looking
right.
at. So, I mean, even the most seasoned probationer may not know exactly what a particular consent agreement says or doesn't say.
Well, I'm trying to wrap my head around the idea that any uncertainty as to the scope of this particular waiver would invalidate it.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm pushing back a little bit on your assertion that, well, he ought to know. He's experienced here.
Well, like I said, it would be nice if we had more evidence. But if we're looking just at a sufficiency of the evidence standard, again, on an unpreserved issue, the evidence is sufficient, even if minimal. And what we have is the same court who entered that judgment taking notice of that judgment. That is sufficient. Again, if we had that court making that specific factual finding, yes, you accepted this probation. Yes, you voluntarily consented to Fourth Amendment searches, would this be clear error? I would submit not. And then there's the whole burden of actually making that argument below, so we have that factual finding, which we don't.
Maybe let's try approaching this from a different angle. What exactly did the trial court take judicial notice of? Did it take judicial notice of the judgment of conviction with the attachment, or did it just take judicial notice of the contents of the file as a whole?
I honestly can't say exactly. The only thing that I think it was specifically asked was the document that contained the waiver, the judgment itself.
If the prosecutor's holding up a document saying, here, I want you to take judicial notice of this, and it's an unsigned document, the court says, yeah, I'll take judicial notice of that. That's a little different than perhaps taking judicial notice of the file
that
may have contained the signed document.
And frankly, I would be a little uncomfortable going into the exact details of that particular exchange and whether it went beyond just one document. We know it included at least one document. I would just defer to the court's reading of the record as to the scope of that notice.
And if the court is taking judicial notice, doesn't Rule 201 require the court to be explicit in what it's taking judicial notice of?
Oh, yeah.
And doesn't judicial notice require taking notice of things like documents, not the judge's own memory, for example?
I know that this court discourages the taking judicial notice of memories as opposed to actual records that exist in those other cases.
Well, and to the judicial notice issue, didn't defense counsel actually ask the trial court for some additional time to brief, to address the waiver or consent after the hearing? I mean, didn't he ask for additional time and the trial court said no?
I don't recall specifically looking at that, Your Honor. So I would just simply defer to the court's reading of the transcript on that point. I do remember that there was a generalized dispute as to what probation agreement was actually in effect and being utilized.
And my recollection of the transcript was, or my reading of the transcript was, defense counsel seemed a bit surprised by the 2018 agreement.
That, I think, is a fair reading of the record. The counsel did represent that that he believed that it was the 2001 probation judgment that was in play in this. So there is some indication in the record, at least, that counsel was unaware of the 2018. Well, that was a good discussion of the preliminary issue. in terms of the other issues going into play here, defense counsel cited a case in support of argument. This was a special needs case. It was a case where the court said that reasonable suspicion basically justified a probationary search even without a waiver or a consent. And so the court said, you know what, I find that one applicable too. That case actually leads to this result. It wasn't an argument actually put forth by the parties. It was the district court deciding on its own that the special needs exception applied. That issue was also actually preserved, actually addressed, and the evidence was sufficient. This is a very low standard. Remember, what we're talking about is the need to supervise those whom the state and the justice system has allowed to not serve a sentence in exchange for a rehabilitative effort, but that is not a rehabilitative effort conducted in complete and absolute freedom. We know that. There are severe limitations on that freedom. There is a reduced expectation of privacy. There is a reduced expectation of privacy rights that is absolutely inherent in this, with or without what we would deem a waiver or a consent. It's a low standard for that. In other words, all we have to have is some reason to believe that there is evidence associated with the management of this person's probation and a search under that circumstance becomes reasonable. That is here. Again, what the probation officers understood about that was put forth in the record, and that was basically that he was associating with other probationers, people who were using, and was using himself. And of course, once they went to the house, they confirmed very quickly that he was hanging out with other probationers. So under the circumstances, the district court correctly found that the special needs exception applied under the very low suspicion requirement for which that would apply. And under these circumstances, the district court did correctly deny the motion to suppress. The state would request this court to affirm, and specifically the state is asking this court to find that that all but the special needs ruling of the court is not preserved for appellate review, simply because Mr. Best counsel presented his theory of the case to the court. The court rejected that theory. That is what can and should be reviewed by this court. Theories raised for the first time on appeal are not properly before this court. Thank you very much.
Before you sit down, counsel, I have a question about an issue that was submitted on the briefing by the appellant. That concerns the body cam footage. I'm not certain, but it looks like the state may have conceded that it was error.
Yes.
Not to allow it, but that it was harmless error.
Yes.
So on the harmless error analysis, my question is, it appears that the defense was prevented from making a proffer, and yet we're being asked to assume this was harmless error. When the defense was arguing this at trial, it was attempting to continue its argument, and the judge in the case said, we're done, you can appeal. If the defense had been allowed to make a proffer, perhaps they'd be able to make an argument here that the error wasn't harmless. But when the court cuts them off like that and says, you're done, just appeal it, how can we assume that the error was harmless?
Well, we might not know the exact argument that would have eventually been made, but we do know the gist of it. And the only thing that the court prevented defense counsel from going into was the significance of the fact that a certain body cam footage hadn't been presented to them as evidence. So this wasn't an argument about the evidence that was presented. It was an argument about the evidence that wasn't.
Right. And I guess my concern is this could have been the weakest, least persuasive argument in the world. I might conclude that, but I don't know what the evidence would have shown. And without knowing what it showed, how I'm not given an opportunity to say, appellant, that's weak sauce. That never would have changed a single juror's mind. I can't say that if I don't know what the evidence was, because the court kept any evidence, any kind of proffer from being made.
I'm a little confused by the question in relation to evidence. The evidence was already before the court. So the argument was the state failed to present certain evidence.
I don't know how clever this defense attorney was or not. I don't know what he would have done with that evidence and what argument he would have made to the jury that he was foreclosed from making because the court never let him take the next step and explain why he wanted this in.
Why did he
appeal it?
Well, I think that the record is sufficient to draw that inference of what the argument was. It was that an officer on the scene had a body cam video. We know what the evidence establishes, what likely would have or would not have been on that body cam video. We know that there was a recording of that same incident presented.
An audio recording. Audio only.
Yes, audio only. So the only thing that we have, and we also know that the defense had that video, utilized it at trial, and also didn't present it. So under those circumstances, I would simply invite the court to exercise its wildest imagination in terms of how effective that could have been. But you don't have to exercise any imagination. We know what it was. It was the state failed to present this evidence, and it would have been somehow exonerating.
I guess my concern is I don't want to encourage courts
Yes.
to prevent defense attorneys from making a proffer by cutting them off and just telling them to appeal it.
I agree with that, Your Honor. One of the things that is that sometimes catches me by surprise is when I talk with trial attorneys, every once in a while I realize that I'm not in Kansas anymore. there is a different mentality often in terms of trial and appeal. And frankly, looking at this entirety of this case, as an appellate attorney, I could probably pick out a dozen or more things where I wish things would have done a little bit more explicitly, a little bit better, just from creating an appellate record. I get to present at the prosecutor's semiannual conference, and one of the things that I talk about very, very, very frequently is creating an appellate record. Why? Because that's not any trial lawyer's or trial judge's priority except in unusual circumstances. They're not thinking, how is this going to look in a transcript? How is this going to look before the Supreme Court? They're trying to get it right, and they're doing the best they can. But you're right. There are certain practices that interfere with creating good records, and certainly cutting somebody off before they have a full chance to create that record is a problem and should be discouraged. However, under the circumstances, we know enough here to actually review whether there is harmless error, and it is harmless. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
6 minutes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a couple of just very brief comments. First, to your question, Justice Brody, about whether there was a request for additional briefing in this case, there was by defense counsel. It's on page 53 of the transcript. And he says, we would like an opportunity to brief. We're, of course, going to take a judicial notice of that, the probation department, and brief it. And then he says, there are some cases on point, specifically State versus Klingler. And then several pages later, defense counsel again references Klingler for the proposition that waivers or consent in this case must be made knowingly and voluntarily. And so I think counsel is asking for a chance to brief the extent of this, the existence of this new waiver and how it applies to this case. And I think the record certainly bears out that defense counsel was very much surprised by the existence of this 2018 agreement.
And apparently, as I read the record, he didn't even have a copy of it.
Correct.
He didn't even have a copy of it at the moment of this hearing.
Yes, and in addition to the request for briefing, there's also a request for a continuance because in addition to receiving this new document, this 2018 document, he also represents that certain subpoenas have been served upon the local police department and hadn't been returned yet, and he asks for more time to deal with that. And so there is both the request for a continuance of the hearing altogether in light of this new evidence and a request for supplemental
briefing on. But that hasn't been raised on appeal as an abuse of discretion.
I agree with that, Your Honor. We did not raise that as a separate issue. But I think it just goes to show that, yes, counsel was surprised by this. And made the arguments that he could in light of, the position that he was in.
But at the same time, he also conceded that file in that case was available.
Yes, it was a public document. He admitted to that, and
so
yes,
I was left with the. I realize he was surprised. I agree, he was surprised, but I was left with the question: did he not look at the right file? Did he not look far enough in the file? Because he concedes, yeah, it was there.
Obviously, we don't have defense counsel's, ideas as to what was going on here. For a case that's arising in 2021, I'm frankly surprised someone would be relying on a probation term from the year 2000. I've been doing this a long time. I don't know how many terms of probation exceeding 20 years I've ever seen. I think it's a pretty rare thing. And so, I do wonder about that. And then as far as just the fact that he was on probation would tend to show that he was also aware of the terms. I think the case law from this court is very clear that whether someone is on probation or not is a very separate question from whether or not they have accepted the actual terms of that probation. So we do not dispute that Mr. Best was on probation in this case. Defense counsel questioned one of the officer Clifford about that. There's evidence in the record of who Mr. Best's probation officer is. So we don't dispute he was on probation. The only question is, as we've said before, did the state meet its burden to show an actual consent in this case? And as far as just preservation generally, I want to be very clear. We're not asking for anything beyond what this court standard for preservation already is. It's generally, raise it in the district court or, get an adverse ruling or make an argument about it. And in this case, there was argument made about knowing intelligent consent in this case. The district court ruled on it, and the state asserted that, you know, we don't need to prove this any further than we already have, because this agreement takes care of it. And so we're not saying that this opens the doors to everything. It's very, you know, Garcia Rodriguez, the case that kind of started the new preservation arguments about 8 years ago, still applies here. So in a case like that, if all that's being argued down below is whether, and in that case it was whether a statute authorized an arrest of someone, the district court or ruled that it did not, the state came back on appeal and said, no, you know, the statute doesn't matter for purposes of this. Only the Constitution matters. And this court said, no, the issue raised on appeal only dealt with the statute. You can't raise your constitutional argument here. The flip side of that would also apply for a defendant. If the defendant argues that they were subject to a legal stop on without reasonable suspicion, the officer comes up and says, well, you know, I pulled him over because I thought the windows on his car, you know, were too dark of a tint for Idaho law. You know, we had reasonable suspicion to stop him. The defendant cannot then come up on appeal and say, oh, it's our position here today that that statute's unconstitutional because, you know, where I got my windows tinted, it was legal at, and now my right to travel throughout the United States is being violated because now my car is now considered illegal in a certain case. So we're not saying you can raise everything under the sun here. We're just saying that in a case like this where the district court actually deals with it, it's preserved on appeal, it was the state's burden to show it, the state didn't, and because of that, we would ask that this court reverse the district court's order. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Counsel, normally we would take this matter under advisement at this moment, but in this case, given the nature of the discussion about the record, I want to give appellant 7 days to file any additional motion or briefing relative to the status of the probation document. It's discussed at length in your beginning comments. Mr. Curtis, the state will have 7 days thereafter to file any response. Appellant will have 7 days for reply. If you don't wish to reply to that, please let us know, because at that time, then this case will be under advisement for rendering a decision in due course. Is that clear as mud? Or?
So essentially just a motion to augment?
If that's what you decide to do, we'll leave that to you, but we're giving you a time window of 7 days to do motion or briefing.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Madam Clerk, are you clear on that?
Yes, sir.
Mr. George, any question? All right. Thank you very much. We'll be in recess for a brief period of time.